can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to learn about purple potato power, and how about the benefits of pears? A lot more than what most people think. Vitamin C can protect against liver injury caused by MSG, and a lot of people are consuming MSG and are not even aware of it. It's very dangerous. This is neurotoxin. It's put in food as a flavor enhancer. Also, we're finding out about how aerobic exercise significantly improves asthma from Concordia University and Montreal Chest Institute, and a lot more on health and healing. Then a commentary from Jim Quinn of Burning Platform, and I think a lot of people relate to this. I know I do, because in the 5 years of crisscrossing America, finding people at all levels of society who were financially struggling, I would ask people, at what point did you realize that you had not saved enough, that you were overspending? And without exception, for most of the people, it was way too late, but they were aware. Then why did they spend when they knew that there would be debt to pay, when they could lose their house or condominium? So how much responsibility do we have for the choices we've made? Sometimes there's this gross overgeneralization that everyone who's poor, everyone who's in debt, everyone who's homeless, it was someone else's fault, someone else's responsibility. Then there are those who, no matter what effort you make to be a responsible, conscientious person with your finances, with your career, when circumstances you cannot control go against you, you're blamed. So it's either or in our society, and I have not seen that to be the case. So there'll be an in-depth discussion and then opening it up for your feedback so you have a chance to share your thoughts. Confusion, delusion, and illusions will be that. I'm giving more time than usual to a guest today because I believe this guest has a lot to share. Professor Joanna Bork. She's a historian, a social feminist, and a scholar from New Zealand. She currently is a professor of history in the Department of History and Classics and Archaeology at Birkbeck University in London. We'll be speaking with her. And she was raised in New Zealand, Zambia, and Haiti. And she has focused her research on the culture and history of war and fear, the history of rape and gender struggle, and the sociology of violence. We're going to talk about the cultural roots of military violence and war and our social life and weapons. I was recently informed that the fastest selling video game in history made over $1 billion in sales in 1 week, more than any movie that quickly in history. It's a very violent film. What impact will that film have on sensitizing a person or desensitizing them to how they respond to violence in the world around them? That'll be our discussion. So we have a lot to share. Also, if time permits, I want to share some insights from a person who spent the last 15 years working in Silicon Valley. Now, we're led to believe that when you're an engineer in Silicon Valley, that's like being tenured as a professor. You're there for life. We hear about and see these wonderful campuses where they have all these great perks for working at these dot-com companies and these tech companies. This person is not a Cassandra, but they are giving us a clarion call. They're saying, it's a bubble. It's a fraud. It's all lies. That everything you thought you knew about Silicon Valley, from a person who lives there, works there, and has succeeded there, is not true. And you better pay attention because the bubble's bursting. Those engineers, they're getting laid off. And there was just a meeting this past weekend in San Francisco, which is right near Silicon Valley, to talk about what's the future. And a lot of these people are saying it's going to be rough. So for those of you, and especially those who are not aware that your pensions are probably invested heavily in the so-called miracle of technology curing everything, well, it doesn't work that way in the real world. Oh, by the way, coming to work early this morning, I read where the good news is some hedge funds have lost $1.5 billion. That's just one. For that investing in that drug company that went from $14 a pill to $700 a pill, and all the profits the hedge funds are making by owning shares in companies that overcharge, well, a little karma. They're losing, I think today they lost $25 billion in the last 24 hours. That's with a B, billion. Well, there's never enough money for these hedge funds to lose to justify the way that they have dealt with people and how they make their money. Let's begin. Potatoes. It was 2 years ago that I was filming America's Greatest Chef. You won't see him on any of the television programs. He doesn't play those stupid, immature games of who can cook the fastest and who's going to get knocked off a show by a bunch of clowns who know nothing about cooking to begin with. But they seem to be great at judging other people's supposed deficiencies. I find all these shows an embarrassment. All reality shows, I think, it's a disgrace to even watch them. I don't blame putting them on the air. That's the way we work. But if you watch one of these shows, you begin to watch these, what's it say about you? So anyhow, when I asked David Boulay, have you ever been invited on any of these? Yeah. Would you go? Never. I have too much respect for what it is to be a chef to embarrass myself by being on one of these moronic shows. I agree with him. We went to the farmer's market. I wanted to see how does he select his food that he prepares. And when we're walking around, it was interesting because he took me to the vendors that he found provided the best produce at Union Square. And they all knew him because he came there personally every day to do the shopping. And then he didn't tell me, but one of the people he was speaking with that I was filming said, you know, David brought in the fingerling purple potatoes from South America. I said, no, I didn't know that. So I asked him. I said, you brought him in? He said, yeah, years ago, I brought him in because of my travels around the world. I love to see what they're growing that's unique in a culinary sense and nutrition. Because David likes to blend the newest information on probiotics, antioxidants, anthocyanins, meaning the healing nutrients in food, and bring that into his cuisine. He's leading the effort as a gourmet chef in making food not just unique and beautiful and tasty, but healing. And his emphasis now is foods that heal. Good for him. And he has, by the way, he has the highest Michelin star ranking in America. So I learned a lot about him bringing in, not just that, he brought in other things and tried them on farms upstate. Now they're popular. So the next time you eat one of those potatoes, you never guess that it was brought in by someone who just wanted to experiment, and it worked. So what do we know, according to Penn State University, about the potato? Well, here's the latest on the purple potato. This is in their scientific model. Quote, purple flesh potatoes contain compounds that suppress the growth of colon cancer tumors. This is in this laboratory model. Quote, purple flesh potatoes are a rich source of anthocyanins, potent plant-based antioxidant compounds. That's according to the researchers up there. And it doesn't matter how they're prepared, they have a very powerful impact upon colon cancer. They turn off inflammation. And they also contain a resistant starch, which serves as a food for the good bacteria in your gut that the bacteria can convert to beneficial short-chain fatty acids, such as butyric acid, a substance that regulates immune function in the gut and suppresses chronic inflammation. End quote. How about that? So, if you want to have a healthier gut and colon, try having some purple potatoes. Now, here's one of the ways I make them. I steam them, which preserves their nutrients. I wash them first. You scrub, always scrub a potato. And then you take, you could take a toothpick, because they're small, and you stick the toothpick throughout the potato, all around it. And what that does, it creates little tiny air pockets. So the heat goes in and starts the process of heating it up on the inside, and then that allows the steam to carry out, so you get quicker heating, quicker cooking, more evenly heating, where the average person just puts it in a oven and turns it up to 400 degrees. What that does, it overheats the outside and therefore destroys a lot of the nutrients, including alpha-lipoic acid, a very important antioxidant that's in the skin. The skin to about a quarter inch under the skin is your alpha-lipoic acid, but also it contains calcium, magnesium, vitamin C. People never think a potato containing vitamin C. It does, almost as much as an orange. So then you blanch it. Blanch it means you just pour cold water over it, and then thinly slice it, and put those thinly slices into a ceramic jar, and put your favorite seasonings in it. Now, maybe your favorite seasoning is rosemary, or rose, or basil, olive oil, and then some spices, and you let it marinate overnight. Then you use that into a cold potato salad. That's a different type of potato salad. That's a purple potato salad. And now we know, aside from being delicious and unique, it helps with colon cancer, both in prevention and treatment. Also, a new study from Brown University School of Public Health shows that mindfulness is linked to lower obesity and less belly fat. Quote, a study of nearly 400 people finds that those who exhibited more mindfulness or awareness of and attention to their current feelings and thoughts were less likely to be obese and had less abdominal fat than people who did not exhibit awareness. Okay, I think that's rather common sense based. Look, there's a moment where all of us are drawn between a compulsion to do something. We want to do it. We just walk by a bakery and we smell bread and we want a piece of bread. We don't care if we're gluten intolerant or whether we need that or not. And then part of us says, that smells nice, but I don't eat bread. I don't need the gluten. I don't need the empty calories. So I'll enjoy the smell and keep walking. Just like going through a botanical garden. You love the smell, the aroma, but you don't have to cut the flower and take it home with you. That moment of decision, once you begin to discipline yourself to say, what is the likely outcome if I do this? And in that moment, have an honest dialogue with yourself, then you're far less likely to do the things that could hurt you in the short or long term. We just haven't been trained to be mindful in this current generation, though there was a time in American history where you had to be mindful, your life depended upon it. You had to be self-sufficient, you had to be aware, and you had to be highly disciplined, or you wouldn't survive. Think of the pioneers. So today, everything's done for us. Our thinking is done for us. Testing is done for us. There's so low standards in everything that all we have to do is just show up and somehow we're supposed to be rewarded because we participated in life, so give us a reward. And that's unfortunate. That doesn't strengthen us, it weakens us. So if you don't think there's a consequence to eating something you shouldn't, or drinking something, or smoking something, or taking something, or saying something, then you'll do it and then someone will apologize for you later. Unfortunately. But that study shows also works the other way, that is, healthier. A new study shows that vitamin C can help negate the effects of monosodium glutamate. Monosodium glutamate, or MSG, is in a lot of foods, but it doesn't say MSG. It might say food flavor enhancer, for example. But just know this, it is a known neurotoxin. It's bad to the bone. It enhances flavor, and that's why it's been used in a lot of restaurants for a long time, and is still used in a lot of restaurants. But it damages your liver. Vitamin C can help protect against liver injury caused by MSG. That's this newest study. So don't consume it because it can hurt your brains, nervous system, and your liver. But if you do, take 1 or 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C. The article was published in Experimental and Toxicologic Pathology. And how does it work? Why would vitamin C work? It's believed that vitamin C works to reverse the impact of MSG on the liver by causing a significant drop in unhealthy growth cells and reducing mutations of tumor suppressor genes. It also has a protective effect on the liver. That's why anyone who drinks alcohol should always take extra vitamin C and glutathione and milk thistle, and that'll help. Pears, University of Minnesota. A scientist there did some professor of food science, nutrition, wanted to find out why should we eat pears. Well, took a look at the pear and found that the pear is an outstanding source of fiber, vitamin C, it is low in calories, it's good for diabetics, and one medium pear provides 24% of your daily fiber needs. It has no sodium, no cholesterol, it's fat-free, has a lot of potassium, nearly 200 milligrams of a medium-sized pear. So it's just a very good, healthy fruit to eat, especially if you're overweight, if you're diabetic, if you are constipated. It can help you with all that. And it's very good for your intestine and gut health. So from this study, they're finding, make sure that you get a pear into the diet. And they're saying that a pear is right up there with citrus fruits and leafy vegetables and contributing to protecting you from a stroke. And that's good. And also significant improvement if you have asthma, if you engage in aerobic exercise. This is Concordia University and Montreal Chess Institute. Quote, researchers from the hospital, Montreal, and the Chess Institute conducted a 12-week supervised aerobic exercise program for patients with asthma and found that exercise yielded significant improvements in asthma control. So, that's good. So, they're suggesting do some aerobic exercise every day. I would absolutely agree with that. And if you have some cellulite on your thighs, but not your stomach. This is from a research study done in France. Try melon juice. Quote, melon juice reduced cellulite on thighs. So they took a group of women in a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. These were healthy women, but they had cellulite. They were between 31 and 50 years of age. And they measured their body mass index, and it averaged between 23 and 30%. In my opinion, that's very high. And they used this for 56 consecutive days, and they found that the melon juice, quote, it made significant differences in the cellulite results and the fat lobules, adipose tissue, protrusions into the dermis, and changes in connective tissue fibers leading to fibrosis. So, big difference. 71% reduction. 71%. How about that? So, who knew? Who knew that melons? You could use cantaloupe, watermelon, any of the melons. They're all good. Canary melons, they're great. All right. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you from all over the world. We're going to be having our guest up here in a few moments, about 12 minutes, talking about the cultural roots of military violence, war play, and the social life of weapons. Professor Joanna Bourke from the United Kingdom on that. But some other interesting thing, this is from The Atlantic. The New York Police Department is using mobile X-ray vans to spy on unknown targets. That's not good. To me, that's dystopian. I've been talking about that for some time. Quote, the New York City Police now maintain an unknown number of military-grade vans outfitted with X-ray radiation, enabling cops to look through the walls of buildings or the sides of trucks. The technology was used in Afghanistan before being brought to U.S. streets. Each X-ray van cost up to $825,000. Wow, it's almost $1 million a van. New York City Police Department will not reveal when, where, and how often they are used. Quote, I will not talk about anything at all about this, New York Police Commissioner told a journalist for... All right. Well, here are some questions that we should ask New York City Police Department. How is the NYPD ensuring that innocent New Yorkers are not subject to harmful X-ray radiation? How long is the NYPD keeping the images that it takes, and who can look at them? Is the NYPD obtaining judicial authorization prior to taking images, and if so, what type of authorization? Is the technology funded by taxpayer money, and has the use of the vans justified the price tag? Those are the least that they should tell us. But I've mentioned many times on this program, now it's public knowledge. It's out there in a story today. I said that they were driving up and down the streets. They could stop in front of your house and see everything you were doing and hear everything you were doing and didn't need a warrant to do it. But no one said that it was X-ray equipment. That means you're as if you're getting X-rayed. Well, what would that do? Pointing an X-ray beam at you. That's extraordinarily irresponsible, but it should be investigated. Here's something else that we should just take a moment and think about. Let's just say that you're one of a percentage of Americans who are afraid that the government is plotting to confiscate your firearms, or you believe that the economy is about to collapse and the government will soon declare martial law, or you display an unusual number of political and ideological bumper stickers on your car. If you answered yes to any of these, you may be an anti-government extremist, meaning, aka, a domestic terrorist in the eyes of the police. That is true. According to John Whitehead, you are now viewed as a greater threat to America than ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Impossible? No, it's not. Let this sink in for a moment. If you believe in and exercise your right under the Constitution, namely your right to speak freely, worship freely, associate with like-minded individuals who share your political views, criticize the government, own a weapon, demand a warrant before being questioned or searched, or any other activity viewed as potentially anti-government, then you have just been promoted to the top of the government's terrorism watch list. Now, I am not adding any hyperbole to this. Police agencies now believe, quote, the main terrorist threat to the United States is not from violent Muslim extremists, but from right-wing extremists. So if you criticize your government, you're considered right-wing extremist. Well, I know an awful lot of people who criticize the government who are not right-wing. So the government is now profiling you? building cases against you. You're on their watch list. You are now considered an extremist. If you say anything, it's anti-government. Under the guise of fighting violent extremism in all of its forms and manifestations in cities and communities across the world, the Obama administration has agreed to partner with the United Nations to take part in its Strong Cities Network program. Working with the UN, the federal government will train local police agencies across America in how to identify, fight, and prevent extremism, meaning anyone who is critical of the government, and will address intolerance within their communities using all the resources at their disposal. And what this program is really about is community policing on a global scale. And when applied to the Strong City Network program, the objective is ostensibly to prevent anyone from speaking out on anything that they don't want you to speak out on. In other words, police acting ostensibly as extensions of the United Nations, a completely corrupt criminal organization, in my opinion, that has a few good people doing a few good things. But remember, look who was behind the invasion of Libya. Look at who is behind the cholera epidemic in Haiti. I could show you 1,000 things they've done wrong. And if you want to see them, you won't. If you do, you will. But they are controlled. They'll identify, monitor, and deter individuals who exhibit or express or engage in anything that can be considered anti-government. So if you want a foretaste of how extreme things could get in the United States, new anti-terrorism measures in the UK require that extremists, meaning anyone who challenges the government, be treated like pedophiles and banned from working with youngsters and vulnerable people. That's how crazy it is. The government's war on what they consider extremists, of which the Strong Cities program is a part, is being sold to Americans in much the same way that the U.S. Patriot Act was sold to Americans, as a means of combating terrorists who seek to destroy America. For instance, making the case for the government's war on domestic extremism, the Obama administration has suggested it may require greater legal powers to combat any form of extreme anything. So how about people who go after corporations that are corrupt, like Wall Street banks? And how about people who speak out about environmental polluters, like Michio Kaku speaks out, Helen Colicott speaks out, Harvey Wasserman speaks out? Are they now on a terrorist list? I would bet anything they are. What if you speak out against the corruption of the Justice Department? You're on a terrorist list. So just as I told you a long time ago, they're going to be coming up and down the streets. They're going to be looking now from WikiLeaks. We have information that every single Occupy Wall Street movement had multiple protagonists for the government side who were saboteurs, provocateurs, and informers inside, getting all the information on every college campus in America where they had a meeting. And then every environmental group, animal rights group, everyone who's been against GMOs, you're on their list. So let's see how that works out for people. Now, there is another aspect to all this that concerns me, and that is that we're not paying attention to the basics, and we need to get back to the basics. The basics of how do we take back our country from those politicians who have compromised their principles and morals and ethics, from those, not all corporate leaders by any means, but those corporate leaders who believe in power above all and will do anything, corrupt any system, buy off anyone to make sure that their laws, their rules apply. They write almost all the laws today. If you doubt me, look at the corruption, complete and total venal corruption of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how it will pass and become law. And then you'll ask, where were all the unions? Why didn't they ask for a national boycott? Then maybe you'll have a better perspective of how compromised to get close to power. People who have power will exercise it versus those who don't have power. Now, there is something we can do, and it is constructive. We can be honest about our problems. In my travels around the United States, one particular filmed interview sticks out. And this was a family of four, two daughters, teenagers, husband and wife, both engineers, who had worked at NASA, lost their job, and were now homeless, living out of their SUV. When I asked them, how did you get to that place, it was because of the following, and I'll summarize it. They had to keep up appearances, even when they had plenty of money left in the bank, but then they had to get mortgages on their home because as the value of their home went up, they kept taking out more mortgages, using it like an ATM machine because, after all, they worked for a private contractor, they worked for the government, and they made nice salaries. So they want to make sure that they could go on their vacations. They like to go to Costa Rica. Well, that's an expensive trip. Their daughters would have to go to the mall after school each day. And, of course, as most people do when they are in that mindset, they buy stuff they don't need using credit cards because it's a bill. It'll be paid. And once they lost their jobs, they didn't try to find other jobs at lower pay because they were sure they'd be rehired at a higher pay. They weren't. Until one day, one of the headhunters that they had signed up with was, they said, quote, brutally honest. When we'd been making, one of them had been making $165,000 a year, and the guy says, I'll be lucky if I can find you a job for $50,000. Do you have any idea how many tens of thousands of people in this area of Florida are out of work, who are highly qualified, highly credentialed, have a heavy lifestyle, lots of bills, and don't want to give anything up, and you're all waiting in the same line for the handful of jobs that'll come through at far less? You better pay attention because people are coming in from other countries who are even more qualified, willing to work for one-fifth what you're willing to work for, and they're getting the jobs. He didn't want to believe it, he said. So they didn't stop buying stuff. In fact, one of the daughters commented that the reason that they had to keep going out every day and buying stuff was because they didn't want to be excluded, because the moment any of their friends were shown to be struggling financially, they were pariah. They were cast out. Some friends. So for us to think that only circumstances itself caused our financial meltdown and destruction of our homes is nonsense, immature, and a lie. We have to look at what we as individuals do, just like the person that's morbidly obese and then has diabetes and can't afford the treatment and then gets depressed. Exactly how did you get morbidly obese? Do you take any responsibility for the choices you make of what you put in your mouth? No, but you want everyone else to pay for it when you do? Yes. And we have this dialogue about who should be responsible, or should anyone ever have to be responsible for any choice you take in your life if someone else pays for the consequences? How many people would be responsible then? What do you think? Let me put it a little simpler. What if you took the windows out of every store, every retail store in America, including every diamond store, every store, and you no longer made it a crime to steal? You couldn't be punished or arrested. How long do you think before every store in America would have nothing left in it? If you're a person of morals and true spiritual values, not religious values, spiritual values, big difference there, you would not steal, even if given the opportunity. You wouldn't. You'd be compromising on what the basis of your life is. But what if your values were distorted? What if your values were compromised? What if you had maladapted your values ideologically, politically, socially, culturally, religiously, so you could fit in and gain? Then when do you take responsibility? 2, Jim Quinn, Burning Platform, an article, Confusion, Delusion, and Illusions. Quote, two recent surveys, along with numerous other studies and data, reveal most American households to be living on the brink of catastrophe, but continuing to act in a reckless and delusionary manner. There have certainly been economic factors beyond the control of average Americans that have resulted in real median household incomes remaining stagnant for the last 36 years. The unholy alliance of mega corporations, Wall Street, and bought off corrupt politicians have gutted the nation of millions of good paying jobs under the guise of globalization, while utilizing debt, derivatives, and financial schemes to enrich themselves. The malfeasance of the sociopathic privileged class does not discharge the personal responsibility of citizens for living within their means. A lack of discipline, inability to delay gratification, failure to understand basic mathematical concepts, materialistic envy, absence of critical thinking skills, and a delusionary view of the world have left the majority of Americans broke and in debt. The data that captured my attention was how little the average American household has in savings. Roughly 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings, and 21% of all Americans have zero savings. But on top of that, they have debt. The dreadful data is reinforced by another survey carried out on adults earlier this year by PersonalFinanceBankRate.com, which found 62% of Americans have no emergency savings for medical crisis, car repair, or unanticipated household expenditure. The fact is, these are not highly unlikely scenarios. They happen every day as part of our routine existence. Everybody gets sick. Every car eventually needs new tires or a new engine repair. Every home will need a new hot water heater or roof at some point. It is foolish and short-sighted not to expect the unexpected expenditures. Living in the moment and fulfilling your immediate desires may feel good today, but leaves you susceptible to disaster tomorrow. Gradually building a rainy day fund over time is what adults should do. Only immature children operate with no safety net. Everyone has an excuse for why they end up living on the edge, but the data exposes us to an infantile nation of spendthrifts incapable of distinguishing between wants and needs. It might be understandable for young adults who are burdened by student loan debt and entry-level jobs to have little or no savings, but the data for older Americans is much more disturbing. It seems 51% of all Generation X adults between the ages of 35 and 54 in the prime earning years of their lives have zero savings, the highest among all age cohorts, with over 20% of them not even having a savings account. This is incomprehensible and reveals an almost juvenile approach to life. Approximately 70% of all 35 to 54-year-old households have $1,000 or less in savings. These are people who should have been working for the last 30 years. To not have put aside anything is beyond irresponsible, and the justification of earning no interest on savings is disingenuous, as they could have earned up to 5% until 2008. This shocking state of affairs can only be laid at the feet of evil bankers and rich corporate titans. Every person has to accept personal responsibility for their own life at some point. There is one surefire way to accumulate savings, and that is to spend less than you earn. It sounds simple, but the vast majority of Americans have chosen to live beyond their means by allowing themselves to be lured into debt by the Wall Street debt peddlers and their Madison Avenue mega maggots selling dreams to willfully ignorant, delusional consumers. Consumer-dependent corporations hawking autos, electronics, glittery baubles, fashionable attire, toxic processed sludge disguised as food and other slave products, Chinese crap, require a vast, unlimited supply of easy money debt to keep profits rolling in, and the Federal Reserve has been willing and able to accommodate them. Those who earned the most didn't have to worry because they didn't pay for that debt. Everyone else, you pay a lot. And so it goes. It is certainly not easy to accumulate savings in an economy stacked against the worker middle class, but it is possible. It requires self-discipline, deferring gratification, patience, budgetary skills, staying employed, and not coveting your neighbor's possessions. The lack of short-term savings is not an isolated data point. It is representative of a nation of narcissistic, live-for-today, ne'er-do-wells who rarely concern themselves with the future or the consequence of their action. They haven't been putting all their spare cash into retirement plans either. When you realize the typical household today has less than $10,000 saved for their retirement, then the mass delusion becomes clear. How could boomers who have worked for up to 40 years and experienced the greatest bull market in history have less than $12,000 in a retirement fund. And then it goes on to talk about how we got there. Now, I would divide this into two things. After all, wasn't it Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, in individuals, insanity is rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and it is the rule. Wall Street and the automobile makers are just one good example. Do you know how much money Americans owe in auto debt? Over $1 trillion. Yeah, it's right up there with student loans. It gets high because people can buy no money down, no payments for 24 months. Oh, and then you'll be paying 20% interest. And there's a whole lot of people that have a lot of debt in automobiles. And they're buying, the latest study shows people are buying bigger cars, more expensive cars. Why? And the study showed, quote, because it gives an appearance of success. The way to become financially successful on a modest income is to buy used cars and drive them for 10 or more years. The years of no car payment can be directed into savings. Very few people choose this path. That is why auto loan debt now exceeds $1 trillion with 40% since 2010. Wall Street wants you to perpetually be in debt, and millions have bought it hook, line, and sinker. So, my thoughts. Some people don't have that opportunity to save because they don't make enough to save. Many millions of Americans work two jobs. The problem is also how much you're paying people for the work they're doing. If you're paying them work labor that is not able to then be spent on their basic necessities, then there's no money left over. Do not blame a person because you put them into a financial juggernaut. If we went back to the 1950s, where people were making a good salary for the cost of living and could therefore have savings, which we did, and not have debt, which we didn't, apply that same principle today. But corporations want to keep the profit, squeeze the worker until there's nothing left for the worker. Now, that's about 55 million workers. Now look at the people who come from families where they're affluent, at least upper middle class. Are they saving their money? The answer is, once again, no. Now, they're the ones that someone should ask, what do you intend to do when things go bad, when you lose your job? And they have no answer. So I think you have to look at the people, the jobs, the culture, the information on television, what we're encouraged to spend our money on, the food we're encouraged to eat, the diseases that come from that, the medicine that we're supposed to take that does not work for those diseases, diabetes, heart disease, cancers, the debt that we incur to the medical industrial complex, the inequality in taxation where the rich don't pay and corporations that are rich don't pay, but you and I do. And then what's left over? The market where you have a bubble market, you want to rent a house, see where you can rent one, where you can afford it. In New York City, an apartment the size of a walk-in closet can run you $2,000, and yet that's considered the new norm. We have a massive amount of greed in those people who have the power to manipulate the market. What we have to counterbalance that is common sense, discipline, and trying to find happiness in the non-material, but in the things that really matter in life, friendships, family, and what we do to make it a better world for other people. There's no price tag on that. And what about all the senior citizens who worked honorably, hard? They weren't collectors. They weren't hoarders. And then someone came and took over their company and stripped off their pensions. And now they have to live on a meager Social Security. Do not paint everyone with the same brush. That's my comment on that editorial. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you all over the world. We have listeners, and you give input, and we try to create the programs and the insights and information that match your needs. In a moment, we're going to my guest in the United Kingdom. I just want to mention that we have, I'm guesstimating, probably more than 10,000 people who have not received their premiums, though they have paid, and they've been waiting, some very patiently, some for months, some for years. What I'm going to do on your behalf is try to get you your premiums. I've asked the station how many are owed, to whom, and I don't get any response. And so what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to ask you to contact my office with your information. What did you purchase from the station? How much did you pay for your premiums? How long has it been? All right, which premiums? I'm going to collect all these, and then we're going to go about at two different levels trying to get you your premiums. It's simple. If people are not given their premiums, they're less likely to support the station in this fund drive or the next. We have to stop thinking short-term, think long-term, and make the listener come first. So contact my office at 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and explain to them how many premiums you're owed, over what period of time. Just have that information ready because I'm sure we're going to get a lot. And I will be your advocate. I will go to bat for you. Because I've let the station know I'm not offering any more premiums. I will pitch, I will help raise money, but not with premiums because I don't want to disappoint people. Also, I'm going to be interviewing for research editors. I'm going to be interviewing for nutritionists, qualified nutritionists, to help give free nutritional counseling. I'll pay you a good salary. I'll pay you a living wage. But then you counsel people for free. And I have so many thousands of people want help. I can only counsel the terminally ill ones. And so you'll call and we'll see about having you come in for an interview on that. Now let's go to my guest standing by. She is Professor Joanna Bork. She is a historian, a social feminist. I gave you her background earlier in the show. And she is the author of Deep Violence, Military Violence, Warplay, and the Social Life of Weapons. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, it's really great to be able to talk to you.
There's a large body of scientific evidence and research that has conclusively shown an association that exists between violent entertainment for children and aggressive behavior. And just last week, Iowa State University published a study that revealed that parents whose lives are filled with anxiety and emotional stress are far more likely to permit their children to play violent video games than parents who are more content and nurturing in their lives and demure. And yet, in the United States at least, this is leading to a national tragedy. The average person has no idea how many toddlers accidentally injure or kill someone with a gun. The Washington Post did an article last week that every week a toddler 3 years or younger shoots either themselves or someone else. And there have been 43 such cases this year. One case involved a child less than 2 years old shooting himself in the torso and dying. And in part, this is due to America's gun culture. We have over 1,000 predator drone operators. We might want to assume all of them have mastery over the most violent war-like video games, whose job is nothing more than to sit in a protected bunker somewhere out in the desert in Nevada and identify a human target. Whether they are a real target or just a person in the area becomes insignificant. They blow them up. Now, those operators, too, in my personal opinion, are products of America's violent nursery to raise killers. However, more deeply, there are the more insidious underpinnings found in the media and entertainment industry and the government war on terrorism and racism and religious prejudice that give rise to this infatuated, violent society. So please focus on the U.S. since we have the largest military in the world and the largest movie industry with the most violent video games in that industry. And take your time and give a clear picture of the inherent violent dimensions of American culture and society, the rule of governance and law that has infused a military spirit throughout American life. The forum is yours.
Yeah, I think you touch on some really, really important things in our society. I mean, you talk about the gun culture, which is clearly a major, major problem in America right now. And it is, I think, being fueled by violent computer games, video games, particularly, of course, first-person shooters. Now, I mean, my take on this whole huge debate, which has been going on now actually for quite a long time, is that we really do need to pay attention to what our young people are playing. Something like, according to some estimates, between 50 and 90% of teenagers play violent video games. This is a real problem in our society because, as you correctly say, it is teaching people, young people, that violence is legitimate. In these games, of course, to play them effectively, you actually have to master a vast array of technical, military knowledge in order to play the game effectively, so that in itself is militarizing our young people. But also, these games teach a number of really important values. They teach young people to think that war is, if you like, without end. It's perpetual. It's indeterminate. It's even banal, the killing of people. If you look at one very popular game called Conflict Desert Storm, I mean, it's actually, its whole headline is no diplomats, no negotiation, no surrender. These are the kind of values that these games teach. You linked it just a few minutes ago, really interestingly and validly, importantly, to drone warfare, which, of course, is the new way for us fighting other people. And the military itself is very, very aware that the skills that young people, men and women, learn when they're playing on these game consoles are actually extremely valuable in drone warfare. The very same coordination skills, identification skills that young people learn when they're playing, let's say, America's Army, which is the most the largest of these games, are exactly the same skills that are required in real killing. And so you get actually military officers, senior officers, actually admitting that they actually deliberately are recruiting keen gamers because they are very, very effective in real war. The racism thing is also really crucial to this. When young people are playing these computer games, they're not generally shooting at killing in very graphic ways, often a generic enemy. These games, a huge proportion of these games are set within particular context, the new wars of the 21st century. So, they are shooting at people who very definitely look Middle Eastern. They're shooting in environments that are set in the Middle East. So that kind of racism is really, really important. And, I think one of the reasons I called the book Deep Violence is because it's fundamentally, the violence in our military violence in our society is actually deeply embedded in the language that we use. I'll give you just a few examples. A couple of years ago, while I was writing the book, the British Army introduced their first combat sidearm for their first in about 50 or so years, called the Glock 17. And it was really amazing seeing the headlines, which is, the headlines were always, here, we've introduced this new combat sidearm, it's a lifesaver. As though the people who are going to be killed by these sidearms, in fact, don't truly have lives. And I think, in a lot of the ways we talk about war, there's this kind of cognitive forgetfulness. We forget that it's actually real people that we're killing. So, there's always phrases like, delivery will be achieved. We're delivering flowers. Bombs are called clean bombs. Fusion bombs are called clean bombs, even though they're 700 times more powerful than the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So this cognitive forgetfulness, I think, is a real issue within our society because it's so embedded in just the way we talk about things.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. During the past half century, war crimes have gradually been removed from the international community's agenda as issues that deserve immediate attention and legal ruling to prevent them from being repeated. And yet repeatedly, independent human rights organizations have ruled leading countries, particularly the United States, Israel, and the United Kingdom, as perpetrators of crimes against humanity in war zones. Our drone program is one, with more civilians murdered than actual terrorists, and then the strategy is simply ruled collateral damage. Or the recent bombing in the hospital in Afghanistan, or Israel's having been repeatedly charged with international crimes against humanity towards Palestinian civilians and children, and yet nothing has been done to punish anyone in any of these countries. So what does it say when even the international community is impotent or hogtied to do anything regarding terrible war crimes because the United States and its closest allies block any effort for tribunals to proceed, and then this in turn gives the U.S. and other countries license to simply continue committing these same acts over and over again?
I'm really so pessimistic about this aspect of international law. International law has, I think, patently failed to live up to its promise when it, the great sort of treaties and promises that were made, they've actually failed to live up to them. And indeed, I think it's actually more worrying than that, because to a large degree, international lawyers, not all, of course, but a large proportion of international lawyers are actually employed by the military explicitly to provide rationales for increasing warfare, increasing combat casualties, providing excuses and in fact, legal explanations and legal justifications for actions that end up killing women, children, non-combatant men. International law has really been very subverted. I think it's really a worrying thing when we have a situation where the killing of large numbers of people is justified in the name of human rights, in the name of humanitarianism. And that's certainly what's happening. I think, one of the things, in my view, we need to keep reminding ourselves is that this violence that we are producing, I'm speaking now as a British person, but also I think America is the biggest military power, violence circulates, and what violence we commit eventually circulates back to us. Violence goes from soldiers to civilians in the sense that our soldiers in, let's say, Afghanistan and other places, they bring weapons back and they use them against us. Violence also circulates from friends to enemies. In other words, our technologies for killing eventually are adopted by our enemies and they use it against us. And I think drone warfare is going to be a very interesting example of that. And it moves from the foreign places to our own homelands, because our violence actually incites greater violence elsewhere. And I think this idea that international law has a duty which it's patently failed to carry out, but also we as citizens, we as voters, need to remind ourselves that our violence circulates back to us.
I appreciate these insights. After all, how can any civilized person look at writing off human lives, women and children and innocent civilians, as collateral damage? No, it's a life. It's a sacred life, and it's been eliminated, and we simply put it into a particular vernacular, so it's no longer relevant. I believe that we have to denounce violence against women, reject the dominant cultural symbolism of violence. We have to become staunchly anti-war, embrace feminist principles, and if we don't do that, then we really don't abhor violence, because our silence and our lack of response then only gives those who are violent the means and the attitude that they can get away with it. So I thank you for the good work that you're doing and have done in your new book, Deep Violence, Military Violence, Warplay, and the Social Life of Weapons. It's an absolutely essential read. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Lovely talking to you.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow.